comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to The Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this gorgeous place we call Earth. Thank you for being here at The Kevin Smith Show. We're talking about freedom of speech. You know, freedom of speech only exists if it protects, if it includes unpopular speech. You don't need a constitutional guarantee to protect what everybody already wants to hear. You need a constitutional guarantee to protect, and you need courts with the guts and the spine to stand up and enforce the Constitution, but you need that to protect unpopular speech. And otherwise, you don't have freedom of speech. Otherwise, you have this. You're free to say whatever the government says you can say. All right, we're going to step out of here. We'll be back with my guest, John DiNardo, right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening has been with us before, but it's been a while since he's been with us, and we are, of course, delighted to have him back with us tonight, John DiNardo. John served in the U.S. Marine Corps. He is trained in electronics, has a degree in science education from Keene University, formerly taught high school physics, and spent 20 years working for Bell Laboratories, working with electronic circuits, designing and building electronic circuits. Since 2002, he has been an avid researcher into ancient historical evidence and modern scientific evidence for what many people call Planet X and many people call Nibiru. A lot of folks, I mean really a lot of folks around the world, are very keenly interested in this Nibiru, this Planet X. There are a lot of things being said about it. How real is it? So, without further ado, let me say, John DiNardo, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show.
Hello, Kevin. I'm happy to be with you and your audience.
John, you know, you've got a background in science, both in terms of your formal education and in terms of your career. And you know, 20 years of working with electronics and electronic circuits, and designing electronic circuits and so forth for one of the major electronics laboratories, really, I guess, on the planet. Before we get into talking about evidence for Nibiru or Planet X, let me ask you to describe for our audience, if you will, how you made the trip from that very sort of scientific kind of a background into doing what you're doing now. How did you, what prompted that, and how did you make that trip?
Well, during the latter years of my career before I retired, I had heard about a book written by Mark Hazelwood in the early part of this century, I should say. And the book is titled Blindsided, Planet X Passes in 2003. Well, it turned out Mark was way ahead of his time, but the principles of the book hold true and stand true today and are quite obviously coming to pass.
Right, now when you say that...
I read about the book, but there was a spiritual resonance there that made it all quite compelling to me.
All right, when you say he was ahead of his time, you're referring to the fact that he thought it was going to happen in 2003, but
right.
Yeah, okay. So it didn't happen, but you think that the rest of his evidence still holds water, huh?
Oh, for sure. And I'll show you the major piece of evidence. I went to my county library and photocopied a landmark article from the New York Times dated January 30th, 1983. I have a photocopy of that article in front of me, and I can email you the JPEG high resolution clear copy of that New York Times January 30th, 1983 article before the National Aeronautics and Space Administration scientists were muzzled by the National Security Agency. At that time, the NSA was not as suppressive because the threat was far away at that time. But then they realized that this subject had to be stifled before it became well known that we had an object as large as a brown dwarf star within the gravitational influence of our solar system and actually being gravitationally drawn in by our sun. So they had to suppress all information. In fact, the cover-up of this story constitutes very strong evidence that the story is true. Because why would they cover up this major find, the greatest scientific find in the history of the world, greater than Isaac Newton's principles of gravity, greater than all of Einstein's principles? And yet, it was totally suppressed after 1984.
Okay, go ahead and tell us what's in the article.
Okay, New York Times, Sunday, January 30th, 1983, titled, Clues Get Warm in the Search for Planet X, by John Noble Wilford. Quote, something out there beyond the farthest reaches of the known solar system seems to be tugging at Uranus and Neptune. Some gravitational force keeps perturbing the two giant planets, causing irregularities in their orbits. The force suggests a presence far away and unseen, a large object that may be the long-sought Planet X. Now, this is a very long article, but I can read more.
Well, I don't know if it's part of... I don't know if it's part of that article, but I do know that at about the same time, the chief scientist on the IRIS satellite made a statement and said, we found something out there. We don't know what it is, but it's huge.
And that was exactly 11 months later, and I had that article. I photocopied that article also from my county library's archives. That was front page, Washington Post. So here we have the two largest newspapers in the United States, the New York Times and the Washington Post. At the launching of this infrared astronomical satellite, this New York Times article was published talking about this, and I'm going to quote again from the New York Times article, the infrared astronomical satellite was boosted into a 560-mile high polar orbit Tuesday night from Vandenberg Air Force Base, California. It represents an $80 million venture by the United States, Britain, and the Netherlands. In the next 6 or 7 months, this telescope is expected to conduct a wide-ranging survey of nearly all the sky, detecting sources not of ordinary light, but of infrared radiation, which is invisible to the human eye and largely absorbed by the atmosphere. Scientists thus hope that the new telescope will chart thousands of infrared-emitting objects that have gone undetected, stars, interstellar clouds, asteroids, and with any luck, this object that pulls gravitationally at Uranus and Neptune. And that's the beginning of the article, but 11 months later, the object was actually discovered by this infrared astronomical satellite, and it was heralded. The discovery was heralded on the front page of the Washington Post, December 30th, 1983. And here's the title of the article: Mystery Heavenly Body Discovered, Possibly as Large as Jupiter, by Thomas O'Toole, Washington Post staff writer. Quote, a heavenly body, possibly as large as the giant planet Jupiter, and possibly so close to Earth that it would be part of this solar system, has been found in the direction of the constellation Orion by an orbiting telescope aboard the U.S. infrared astronomical satellite. So mysterious is this object that astronomers do not know if it is a planet, a giant comet, a nearby protostar that never got hot enough to become a star, a distant galaxy so young that it is still in a process of forming its first stars, or a galaxy so shrouded in dust that none of the light cast by its stars ever gets through. All I can tell you is that we do not know what it is, Dr. Jerry Neugebauer, infrared astronomical satellite chief scientist for California's Jet Propulsion Laboratory and director of the Palomar Observatory for the California Institute of Technology, said in an interview. The most fascinating explanation of this mystery body, which is so cold it casts no light and has never been seen by optical telescopes on Earth or in space, is that it is a giant gaseous planet as large as Jupiter and as close to Earth as 50 billion miles. While that may seem like a great distance in Earth-bound terms, it is a stone's throw in cosmological terms. So close, in fact, that it would be the nearest heavenly body to Earth beyond the outermost planet, Pluto. Quote, if it is really that close, it would be a part of our solar system, said Dr. James Hauck, Cornell University's Center for Radiophysics. And that's just the beginning of the article.
Well, I remember reading those articles. I remember at the time when those articles came out, I read them. I was quite impressed by them. Let me ask you a question about this. You know, this article points out that it's so cold it's never been seen. It gives no visible light. But isn't Nibiru and all the stories about it, it's supposed to be visible. They call it the red planet and the winged destroyer and so forth. So they've seen it. Ancient people have seen it. So that would not match the description for Nibiru, would it?
Well, when it gets close, it begins to light up and emit visible light. When it's far away, it's a smoldering, slow-smoldering brown dwarf star. It emits primarily infrared light, which is invisible to the eye. And that's why it cannot be seen yet. But as it gets closer into our solar system, it's being reeled in by that great fisherman, our sun, gravitationally reeled in. And as it gets closer, it actually penetrates the heliosphere at the outer bounds of our solar system. Now, the heliosphere is visualize a huge sphere composed of glowing red plasma. It's actually ionized gases that are blown out by the sun in all directions. And they build up, these ionized gases build up sort of like waves would build up on the shore after continually striking the shore. And that's how this heliosphere is built up. Now, when this planet comes through, it's like a huge bee flying into a huge bubblegum bubble. And it, rather than getting engulfed in sticky bubblegum, it becomes engulfed in that electrically sticky plasma. As you know, electrical particles, such as electrons or protons, will stick to objects such as plastic And when you unpack, for example, you unpack a box, there's lots of these styrofoam peanuts.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll notice that whenever you dip your hand in there, they stick to your hand, and it's very difficult to get them off. You have to shake them off. That's because they are electrically sticky. Similarly, this planet, it becomes engulfed in plasma, and as it gets closer to the sun, it excites the sun electrically, and the sun excites it mutually. And as a result, this planet begins to glow. And that's why the ancients saw it with visible light, because it came in the past, 36 and a half centuries ago, in fact. And they had evidence all of the devastation. Evidently, most of the people on Earth were killed, or many were killed, during past passages.
Okay, now you said this is a brown dwarf, right? This is not a planet. This is a brown dwarf, right?
That's right. A brown dwarf is, as I stated in the New York Times article, that's a protostar, basically a beginning of a star where cosmic gases swirl around in a disk, and the gravitational force of these gases pull them all together at the center. And as it builds up like a snowman. You would roll a snowball,
mm-hmm.
and it continually picks up more and more snow and gets bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, that's how a star is formed, or a baby star. So
okay.
This thing is a brown dwarf star. Now, by definition, the smallest, puniest brown dwarf star is about 3 Jupiter masses. Now, 1 Jupiter mass is 318 Earth masses. So, very conservatively estimating, if this were a puny brown dwarf star, it would be somewhere close to 1,000 Earth masses. And because of that great mass, we know by our own experience with gravity every day, and by Sir Isaac Newton's universal law of gravitation, the gravitational force of attraction, or I should say the magnitude of the gravitational force of attraction between two masses is directly proportional to the mass of body A multiplied by the mass of body B. And, you know, in this common example, our weight, a human being, a person who weighs 200 pounds on Earth, this would simply mean that he has a certain amount of mass in his body, and that compares to the mass of planet Earth, and the resulting gravitational force of attraction between that man's mass and Earth's mass is what is measured in pounds of force, 200 pounds. But if that man were to go to the moon, for example, his weight would be maybe about one-fifth of what it is on Earth. It would be a smaller fraction. So the gravitational force of attraction depends on those two factors, the mass of body A multiplied times the mass of body B. So
okay.
What you're going to have is an accelerating body coming into our solar system, because the closer it gets, the greater the gravitational force of attraction, like a magnet. If you were to place a strong magnet on your table and place a ball bearing within the magnetic field, even the outer the boundaries of that magnetic field, the ball bearing would begin to roll slowly. But as it got closer, the magnetic force of attraction between that magnet and that ball bearing would increase exponentially, not just linearly, but exponentially. In other words, if once the ball bearing got half the distance away from the magnet, its magnetic force of attraction would not be double, but magnetic force of attraction would be quadrupled. So you see, it's very this thing is really accelerating
mm-hmm.
into our solar system. But now, compare it to a fisherman. A fisherman reeling in a huge fish, and as he pulls the line forces directed along that fishing line, and that's how the fish is accelerated toward the fisherman as the fisherman pulls in. The fish is analogous to Planet X, this brown dwarf star. The fisherman is analogous to the sun. As a fish comes in, it begins to overshoot. As it gets close to the fisherman, it goes over his head.
All right, John, we have to step away for break. You're talking about one of my favorite subjects, though, fishing, in that example. And we'll come back right after this, more with John DiNardo, folks, so don't go away.
Listening to the Kevin Smith Show.
All right, you are indeed listening to the Kevin Smith Show. This is Kevin Smith. My guest this evening, John DiNardo. And John, you're using an example. Whenever we had to step away for break, and you were talking about how the sun is reeling in this brown dwarf, much like a fisherman reels in his catch.
Yes, and during the time when the fish, as our example, is far away, most of the force that is being exerted by the fishermen along that fishing line is directed toward the fishermen. But as the fish gets closer and begins to go over the head of the fisherman, now that reeling force is no longer pulling the fish toward the fishermen, but the fish the force has to be pulled backward in opposition to the direction of the fish, which is overshooting the head of the fisherman. So the fisherman has to actually pull back on the fish. So whereas before the fish was accelerating toward the fisherman, now the fish is decelerating, slowing down as the fisherman pulls backward on the fish, causing the fish to loop around, make a big U-turn over the top of the head of the fisherman.
Well, I'll tell you what, any fisherman that has fish flying over his head needs to go learn how to use that rod and reel. But I do understand.
Right. I stretched the analogy a little bit.
Yeah, I do understand what you're saying. Okay, now this brown dwarf that was discovered, and the announcement came out in 1983, the chief scientist on the IRIS satellite project, Dr. I think it was it Neugebauer?
That's right, Dr. Jerry Neugebauer.
Jerry Neugebauer announced this, and so he said that it was discovered in the direction of the constellation Orion. Now, you have done a lot of study into what ancient people had to say about this thing, whether we're going to call it Planet X or Nibiru or whatever you want to call it. You've done a lot of research into what they had to say about this. You know, some of those ancient people claim that their ancestors were from the stars and that they came from the direction of Orion. They point to Orion and say that's where they came from. What do you think about all that?
I don't believe that aspect of the story. There's so much evidence, we don't even have to delve into the idea of aliens from mm-hmm. another planet.
Okay.
Even though this is a thesis of Zechariah Sitchin, his landmark book, The 12th Planet.
Mm-hmm.
His book has a tremendous amount of what I believe to be, and what's shown to be, accurate ancient historical information. without even going into the concept of aliens visiting Earth. And I do have a belief that there are spiritual beings that can possibly be involved in this whole story, this whole scenario.
Mm-hmm.
But without going into that area, I can tell you what I'm going to read from Zechariah Sitchin's book, The Twelfth Planet, page 240. Now, this is what the historical evidence shows. He's quoting from the ancient texts of the Hittite and Ninevite and Babylonian astronomers. A quote from page 240, recognized as a great traveler in the heavens, soaring to immense heights at its apogee. Apogee is the farthest distance above Earth. And then coming down, bowing unto the heaven at its perigee. Perigee is its closest approach to Earth. This planet was depicted as a winged globe. Wherever archaeologists uncovered the remains of Near Eastern peoples, the symbol of the winged globe was conspicuous, dominating temples and palaces carved on rocks, etched on cylinder seals, painted on walls. It accompanied kings and priests, stood above their thrones, hovered above them in battle scenes, was etched into their chariots. Clay, metal, stone, and wood objects were adorned with this symbol. The rulers of Sumer and Akkad, Babylon and Assyria, etc., all revered this symbol. Hittite kings, Egyptian pharaohs, Persian shahs, all proclaimed the symbol and what it stood for supreme. It remained so for millennia. Central to the religious beliefs and astronomy of the ancient world was the conviction that this 12th planet, the planet of the gods, remained within our solar system, and that its grand orbit returned it periodically to Earth's vicinity. The pictographic sign for this 12th planet, the planet of the crossing, was a cross. End of quote. So the ancients saw it, they said it made a periodic orbit into our solar system. And I'll show you some scientific evidence. From this was one of the last articles put out by the mass media on the discovery of this brown dwarf star, Planet X, back in 1983. I'm quoting, this is the third out of five articles that I photocopied from my county library. This is U.S. News and World Report. This is all on the internet. I've posted all these with high-quality JPEG photos to various people, various web pages. U.S. News and World Report, that's the third largest news magazine in the United States, September 10th, 1984. I'm reading, the title of the article is Planet X, Is It Really Out There? Quote, shrouded from the sun's light, mysteriously tugging at the orbits of Uranus and Neptune, is an unseen force that astronomers suspect may be Planet X, a tenth resident of the Earth's celestial neighborhood. Last year, the infrared astronomical satellite, IRAS, circling in a polar orbit 560 miles from the Earth, detected heat from an object about 50 billion miles away that is now the subject of intense speculation. Quote, all I can say is that we don't know what it is yet, says Jerry Neugebauer, director of the Palomar Observatory for the California Institute of Technology. Scientists are hopeful that this one-way journeys of the Pioneer 10 and 11 space probes may help to locate this nameless body. Some astronomers say the heat-emitting object is an unseen collapsed star or possibly a brown dwarf, a protostar that never got hot enough to become a star.
All right, why is it called the planet?
A number of astronomers insist that the object is a dark, gaseous mass that is slowly evolving into a planet.
Why is it called, John, why is it called the planet of the crossing?
Okay, let me give you a vivid visual analogy.
All right.
There's a racetrack. You've seen these Olympic racetracks that are circular or elliptical?
Yeah.
And, of course, each you have one track within another placed concentrically so that the runners run in a circle or an ellipse without interfering with one another.
Okay.
As long as each runner stays in his own lane, there won't be any, will not be any collisions. Now, if you have a crazed spectator standing outside the track, and he suddenly runs directly through, crosses over all the paths inward toward the center of those tracks, he's going to cause mayhem. He's going to be bumping into runners and causing collisions. Well, mm-hmm. that's what is happens with this planet. Now, fortunately, there are no collisions. There's a tremendous distance between all the planets. But also, there's something known as repulsion forces. When large bodies get very close, they tend to repel one another. And that's why this object does not go straight into the sun, which is what you would expect with basic Newtonian physics. If the sun were that huge fisherman pulling that fish, Planet X, directly inward, you would think that that this Planet X's brown dwarf star would crash right into the sun. But because when it gets closer, there's a repulsion force. And this is a very difficult concept to explain. I think very few scientists really understand it. Most of them look at it in a theoretical sense without, you know, observing. They observe the phenomenon without really understanding it.
Well, all moving bodies collide. All moving bodies produce a bow shock. And a bow wake, if you will, out in front of them. You know, space is not empty. And it's whatever's moving through space, big bodies moving through space, produce, if you will, kind of a cosmic wake around them. They have a bow shock. And they have a tail. You know, they've even photographed the Earth's tail. A lot of people never thought about that, but yeah, the Earth produces a tail, and it would seem to me that an incoming body with its bow shock hitting the bow shock of other bodies, that's of course they're going to kind of push away from each other.
Mm-hmm.
I would think. All right.
Right.
Now, it's called the Planet of the Crossing, and the symbol for it is a cross.
Yes.
Does that have any particular importance?
Well, there's a great prophet, which I believe is God, a great prophet by the name of Jesus, who prophesied that he would come back and his sign, the sign of the Son of Man, would be seen in the skies and the entire world would see it. And that would be the sign of the Lord Jesus is a cross. He tells us that we're going to be seeing a blazing cross in the sky. Doesn't tell us specifically that, but that's what if you put the clues together, you see that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the Emperor Constantine converted from paganism, Roman paganism, to Christianity back around the year 300 AD because Constantine was in a pitched battle and suddenly he saw this blazing red cross in the sky that led to his victory. And ever since then, he adopted Christianity in the Roman Empire. Now, that was a comet that came by. And it may not have been coincidental, but it might have been divinely sent. Now, this is a phenomenon. We have seen it. The ancient Indians from the southwestern United States have the famous Thunderbird symbol. That Thunderbird was a comet that they saw in the sky, it spread out with plasmatic wings streaming outward from the sides. And then when it gets close enough, when an object, again, this is all explained by principles of electricity and magnetism.
Okay, John, we have to step away for a break. It's going to take over now in about 6 seconds. Ladies and gentlemen, more with John DiNardo on the other side of the